loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. Senator Dianne Feinstein has released the Senate committee testimony of Fusion GPS co-founder Glenn Simpson against the wishes of Republican Chuck Grassley, the chair of the committee, in this, the latest twist in the Russiagate saga. Next, tenants in Maryland are suing the property management firm controlled by Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner's real estate company, and an Israeli corporate entity provided $30 million to the Kushner's properties in Maryland before Trump sent Kushner to Israel and the Middle East, and before Trump announced that the U.S. was recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. We'll talk about this and the potential for a conflict of interest. Then we turn to Korea. North and South Korea have sent high-level delegations to meet together at the DMZ. We'll talk about what's next in Korea. But first, we turn to the U.S. Senate. Senator Dianne Feinstein has released the Senate committee testimony of Fusion GPS co-founder Glenn Simpson against the wishes of Republican Chuck Grassley, the chair of the committee, in this, the latest twist in the so-called Russiagate saga. We are joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot, The Scapegoat, Russia. Welcome back, Dan. Dan Kovalik, how big of a story is this?
Certainly could be a big story. I did read the Washington Post article on it. Apparently, Senator Feinstein released it against the wishes of the Republicans. And so I think it's going to be quite a big deal.
John, one of the other breaking stories is a British ex-spy, that's Christopher Steele, who is the author of the dossier. And the dossier was hired, was put together on the payroll of Fusion GPS.
Right.
And Fusion GPS was hired first by Republican rivals of Donald Trump.
That's
maybe
right.
It was Ted Cruz. Maybe it was Jeb Bush.
Right. We don't know.
Trump won the nomination, and then the Democrats picked up the dossier or picked up Fusion GPS. And Fusion GPS then gave the Steele dossier to Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. And then when she lost the presidential election, the FBI was offering to actually, I believe, purchase the dossier.
To pay for it. That's right. Over $100,000, which is not something that the FBI normally does.
Yeah. So how does that work?
Well, you know, the CIA is intelligence is a cash business, right? Someone gives a source or potential source cash in exchange for information. The FBI doesn't do that. The FBI generally doesn't pay its sources. So the speculation is, and this is in this breaking Washington Post article, the speculation is that the FBI either already had some of the information that the Steele dossier had as well, or the FBI was able to ascertain that at least part of what the Steele dossier contained was true. And so it was in the FBI's interest to offer to purchase the dossier. I think the big issue here, though, is that the Fusion GPS testimony indicates that the FBI had somebody inside the Trump campaign before Trump even won the nomination reporting back to FBI headquarters.
Okay, Dan Kovalik, pick that up then.
Yeah, well, that is a very interesting fact. Apparently, that is true, that the FBI had infiltrated the Trump campaign. And, you know, I think that's something people should be very concerned about. Again, none of us are Trump supporters, but regardless of who was running for president, that a presidential campaign could be infiltrated by our intelligence services should be of great concern, I would think, to everyone. Again, if they're infiltrating a major candidate who, you know, happened to win the presidency, who else are they infiltrating? What other groups are they infiltrating? And that is maybe the the fact that people are not going to focus on, but I think that should be focused on here.
I think that's an important point because historically, liberals or people who consider themselves progressive would always say, beware of the FBI because the FBI is up to no good. Don't talk to the FBI. But because people are hating Donald Trump rightfully and his policies rightfully, they're now seen within the FBI, within Mueller or James Comey, like the safeguard for our democracy. I think Dan Kovalik's right. I mean, if the FBI is infiltrating the Trump campaign, and again, there's been no specific hard evidence of any collusion with Russia, if they're infiltrating it, if the secret police are infiltrating the campaign of people running for elective office, that would seem to me to be like a dagger pointed at the very heart of even the notion of democracy.
Oh, I agree completely. I think this is a very dangerous development. I consider myself to be well-informed on American politics and on the history of American politics. And I honestly cannot think of another time when the FBI had infiltrated an active presidential campaign.
And let's go, Dan Kovalik, to some of the other things that people need to wrap their heads around, need to think about. According to this Post article that's just out, Christopher Steele was the one who reached out to the FBI with his concerns in early July 2016, according to people familiar with the matter. Now, just think about that. Christopher Steele is a foreign intelligence agent who's hired by rivals of Donald Trump in the Republican Party and then the Democratic Party. He goes to Russia. Who is he getting information from in Russia? Who is he getting information on Donald Trump? It has to be Russian intelligence agents or other Russian officials. So he's colluding with the Russians. He's colluding with the Russians. And why is he colluding with the Russians? Because he's being paid. In other words, Christopher Steele is not doing this because of his love of American democracy. He's on the payroll of different entities.
Well, exactly. And then the FBI, by extension, by then following his lead and then infiltrating the Trump campaign, really becomes an agent themselves of, by that time, I guess, the Democrats. So the whole thing is rather twisted. And so, again, when they're talking about, you know, alleged Russian meddling into the 2016 election, now we should be thinking about, you know, the FBI's meddling in the election. I mean, obviously, we do not want our intelligence services meddling in our democratic processes, and we have to think about the fact that, you know, former British intelligence are meddling in our election, again, on behalf of, I guess, at one point, the Republicans and then the Democrats.
Christopher Steele is a gun for hire. I mean, that's why he's doing this, right?
Sure, it's quite lucrative.
And where are his sources, John? They're all Russians. Why are the Russians talking to Christopher Steele?
Because they're being paid.
Yeah, he's paying them. So he gets money from Fusion GPS, which gets money from the Republican rivals of Trump or from the DNC. He uses part of that money to pay Russian intelligence agents who are telling him whatever he needs to know because they don't care.
See, that's the nature of intelligence. You don't know if it's true or untrue.
It's just raw data.
Yeah, in many cases, you don't care if it's true or untrue. You write it down, you turn it over to the client, and you let the client figure out if it's true or untrue.
But the client would be, if the client was the CIA, there would be CIA analysts trying to parse whether this is true or not.
That's right.
Where the Democratic National Committee or Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz, they don't care about parsing anything. They just need the dirt.
There is a handful of reasons why someone would provide information to a person like Christopher Steele. 95% of people would do it for money, right? Some do it for ideology. Some do it for revenge. Everybody's got a reason, something that motivates them. But for most people, it's money. Well, if you get used to the money, if you like the money, if you come to a point where you need the money to live, to maintain your lifestyle, you're going to keep telling people like Christopher Steele exactly what it is they want to hear, because then your payday keeps coming every month.
Your payday keeps coming. Steele's payday keeps coming.
And we don't have any idea if Christopher Steele ever vetted any of these sources. You know, at the CIA, at the FBI, elsewhere, you have polygraphs, you have surveillance teams. You have different ways of testing a source to see if he's telling the truth. We don't have any idea if Christopher Steele did any of this stuff.
Dan Kovalik, 30 seconds left. Go ahead. Take us out if you would.
Yeah, well, and again, I think obviously because Steele's getting paid for this, his incentive is to find anything, whether it's true or not, to support the conclusions that, again, by this time the Democrats wanted. And so I think we have to look with great scrutiny on whatever comes out in terms of this dossier.
Yeah, bottom line is we still need to have some evidence about something, some actual evidence.
And the courts need to unseal these other four indictments. I think the American people have the right to know what is happening in this case.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He is the author of The Plot, The Scapegoat, Russia. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
But first, we turn to Baltimore. An Israeli bank is investing heavily in Baltimore apartments owned by presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner, even while Maryland's attorney general is investigating Kushner for forcing tenants out of their homes. We're joined from Baltimore by Matt Hill. He's an attorney at the Public Justice Center who is representing aggrieved tenants in a class action suit brought against Kushner and his companies. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Matt, we've seen a lot of articles in the Baltimore Sun and a terrific piece in ProPublica, but I think most Americans don't even realize this is going on. Can you tell us in a nutshell what's happening?
Yes, absolutely. So essentially, this is what's called a fee-churning scheme in which the landlord, in this case Westminster, the allegations of the complaint are that Westminster takes tenants' rent payments and applies it first to a set of fees that exceed the maximum late fee that they're allowed to charge by Maryland law. Then that sometimes allows Westminster to say that the next tenant's rent payment is late, which then incurs another 5% late fee, which then incurs another set of additional fees that we contend are illegal, and sets the tenant up again to kind of go deeper and deeper into this black hole of fees. So that kind of fee-churning scheme always keeps folks behind. And when you're looking at a market as we are in Baltimore, where housing is increasingly unaffordable, we find that these kinds of fees really keep people from being able to live in their housing, be safe, have it be fair housing, and be able to take care of the other necessities of their lives.
And Matt, is the whole point of this to drive people from their homes?
The whole point, well, let's just be clear. I mean, landlords are in the business to make money. And if they can sense an opportunity to turn a profit by charging an additional fee, they certainly have every motive to try to get away with charging that fee. And so the more fees that they can collect, the more profit that they're going to make. But the consequence, again, for tenants is this repeated churning of fees and this kind of snowballing effect in which you're constantly behind and don't know exactly how much you have to pay in order to avoid eviction.
And we're not talking about a couple of units here. We're talking about 15 different apartment complexes, according to ProPublica, with a total of almost 9,000 separate apartment units. And worth more than $400 million.
That is my understanding.
Yeah, this came into the news, John and Matt, because there's another side to the story. We're talking with Matt Hill, who's representing the aggrieved tenants. But the other side of the story is that Jared Kushner, who's no longer, I think he's technically divested from Kushner Properties or whatever it's called.
Yeah, he was supposed to have done that a year ago this month.
But nonetheless, he's Jared Kushner. It's Kushner. And right before Kushner, who was Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, and purportedly he was going to bring peace to the Middle East, before he made his first trip there, an Israeli insurer paid $30 million to the Kushner family real estate firm shortly beforehand. And this was before Donald Trump announced that Jerusalem would be the recognized capital of Israel by the United States. That Kushner or the Kushner company got this big, big investment or from this Israeli insurer. In other words, there's an element of conflict of interest here. Matt Hill, you followed this story undoubtedly in the media. What's your take on that?
Oh, well, I can't really comment. I don't know enough to speak to the Israeli investment aspect of this. I mean, our suit is certainly focused on what we allege are systemic illegal predatory practices across the board affecting the tenants who live in Westminster properties. And so our focus is really making sure that, that Westminster is no longer able to engage in what we consider a practice that, that is predatory and that does ultimately deprive people of scarce, affordable housing.
And Matt, the Maryland Attorney General has been investigating Westminster for at least, what, a year now. Can you tell us what that's about?
Honestly, I don't really know. I've heard this. I understand it to be true, but I don't know exactly the scope of their investigation. I mean, I understood from some of the articles that I read that, you know, Westminster, the Kushner properties receive a certain amount of funding or some sort of loan guarantees from the federal government. And so that's another aspect of this issue, as well as the body attachments that the Baltimore Sun reported on. In other words, Westminster essentially having people arrested and held as a means to force them to pay alleged outstanding debts.
Oh, well, how does that work?
Well, body attachment is just what it sounds like. If you are a tenant and let's say you've left the property and the landlord alleges that you still owe them for something, whether it's some sort of fee or they want to charge you for what we contend often are illegal cleaning fees after you've left the property and you don't pay and the landlord gets a judgment and you still refuse to pay, there is a process by where the landlord can seek assistance from the sheriff, the police to bring you in and hold you until you answer certain questions and talk about being responsive and paying up. So it's definitely a practice that we think is really detrimental to hardworking folks who are just trying to make it day to day to pay off these sorts of alleged debts. And so, you know, you think the debtor's prison is gone in the United States, but apparently it's alive and well.
In fact, we just talked about that yesterday.
I mean, here you have Jared Kushner, who's the senior advisor to Donald Trump, who's obviously running, well, his family is running a company that's ripping people off. I mean, that's what's going on. It's a form of thievery. They won't go to jail.
Right.
I mean, does your lawsuit seek, in terms of damages, any sort of criminal actions, or is it simply civil?
It's a civil case. We want the company to pay back all of the illegal fees that have been assessed and to stop those practices and to put it all in an enforceable court order.
Brian, I'm looking at this ProPublica piece, and it says here, too, that many of the cases involved former tenants. These are former tenants who had moved out of the complexes several years prior to the Kushner Company's purchase of them, and some involved tenants who possessed clear evidence that they did not owe the money that the company claimed, yet were pursued anyway for several years with late fees and court fees piling on top of the original claims.
And in that article, in response to that, just to emphasize what you're saying, John, so people move out of these apartment complexes and they moved out years before the Kushner family even buys them. But the Kushner family, using this extremely scorched earth, aggressive, litigious policy, goes after them, trying to claim that they have unpaid debts. Even if the people don't have paid unpaid debts, they have to get a lawyer. Right, Matt? I mean, they have to then protect themselves. They have to defend themselves. They're at the mercy of this process.
I'm glad you raised that, because that is another central aspect that I think this whole situation brings up, and that is people do not have the right to a lawyer in these cases. They're dependent on whatever civil legal aid services, which are mostly funded by the federal government still, or at least for the moment they are, in order to put up some sort of legal defense when a landlord comes after the tenant after the tenant's left the property and says, you owe me all this money. Tenants are not generally going to be able to effectively push back and mount the kind of case that they need without an attorney. And as, you know, the Trump administration is talking about cutting civil legal aid funding, that's only going to make the situation worse and even provide less access to people who, again, desperately need that access to defend against these allegations and not end up in debtor's prison.
I mean, you can't have debtor's prison and still call the country a democracy.
No, you can't.
To me, it seems like a fundamental contradiction.
And this notion of debtor's prison is real. What Matt is saying is real. I'm looking at the Baltimore Sun, and it says here that since 2013, as many as 20 people have been arrested It says here, since 2013, corporate entities affiliated with Kushner's company sought the civil arrest of 105 former tenants. 20 were, in fact, detained. So it's actually happening.
Yeah. And the landlords, I mean, they're super rich. This is the Kushner company. I mean, there's no limit to their own sort of opulence and wealth. And then in response to questions, again, I'm looking at the ProPublica, Matt Hill. In response to questions for the May 23rd article, this was ProPublica and the New York Times did it jointly, the Kushner company's chief financial officer said that its approach, meaning going after people long after they had moved out of these housing apartments, that the company's approach when it came to pursuing tenants was in line with industry practices and that it had a fiduciary duty to its ownership partners to collect all money owed by current and former tenants. And again, this means if people are facing something like this or even the threat of it, even if they don't owe money, they might do the calculation and say, I can't hire a lawyer. I can't pay for a lawyer. I might lose anyway because the Kushners have, you know, deep pockets and their lawyers will just go and go and go. And thus, I'll just pay it even if I don't owe it. In other words, it's kind of like hostage taking, right? I mean, maybe that's hyperbolic, but it seems like it to me in terms of the social relationship here between the Kushner company and tenants and poor people. They're mainly working class folks, right? I mean, these are not affluent people who are in these housing complexes.
No, I mean, most of the housing complexes, at least the ones that I've looked at, do have rents that most folks would consider affordable to working class people. I think your point's well taken with respect to body attachments and going after folks who've left the properties after years. And because that too has a snowball effect, because it's not just the alleged damages to the property. They're charging 6%, at least 6% interest, as well as attorney's fees with all those cases, which oftentimes the interest and the attorney's fees grow to exceed the amount of the original, you know, $1,500 debt. And so, again, there's this aspect of just, you know, going through the snowballing sort of fee system in that process as well.
Yeah, I'm looking, John and Matt, at the New York Times article that was published back in May with ProPublica. And I want to read a paragraph and then ask Matt to comment on it. It's amazing. This is just highway robbery by the Kushner family, by these landlords. Quote, here it goes. They complained, meaning the tenants, about Westminster's management's aggressive rent collection practices, which many told me exceeded what they experienced under previous owners. Rent is marked officially late, they said, if it arrives after 4:30 p.m. on the fifth day of the month. But Westminster recently made paying the rent much more of a challenge. Last fall, it sent notice to residents saying that they could no longer pay by money order, on which many residents who lacked checking accounts had relied at the complex's rental offices and would instead need to go to a Walmart or Ace Cash Express and use an assigned WIPS card, a plastic card linked to the resident's account, to pay their rent there. That method carries a $3.50 fee for every payment, and getting to Walmart's or Ace is difficult for many residents without cars. So they're deliberately setting a situation up where people can't pay their rent on time so that they can charge them these fees.
And as Matt points out, oftentimes the fees equal more than the rent itself.
Yeah, tenants who pay after, this goes on, tenants who pay after the 5th are hit with late fees that start around $40 to $50 and escalate from there with court fees usually added as well.
And both the New York Times and ProPublica found that many of the fees that are assessed against these tenants are not court mandated fees. They're just fees that the Kushner companies are throwing in without any legal backing at all, essentially just hoping people give up and pay it.
Matt, is that right?
Well, I want to just clarify. I don't think the fees themselves are more oftentimes than the rent that's allegedly still not due and owing, although in certain cases that does happen. We alleged at least one time where the tenant, one of our clients who's a named plaintiff in the class action, was current on the rent, and yet because his money was misallocated to the fees, that produced more late fees, more court fees. And again, it's that snowballing effect for working class folks who are struggling already to pay for affordable housing that is really the most pernicious aspect of this.
When you're going around in Baltimore, do people know about this case? I mean, it would seem to me, especially because of the visibility of Jared Kushner and his connection to Donald Trump, this would be a major political, legal event in the Baltimore area, is it?
It certainly has had a lot of media interest, and you know, we think that's important. We think class members who are current tenants at Kushner at Westminster Properties should know about this case. We think that former tenants should know about it, and if they'd like more information or to tell us about their experience, they're welcome to call us, and I can provide that phone number.
Go ahead.
It's 1-877-625-9409. And you should dial extension 271 or 235.
Just say it one more time.
Sure. 1-877-625-9409, extensions 271 or 235.
Matt Hill is our guest. We just have a couple minutes left, Matt. I want to have you, if you would, explain to the audience what's next in the legal proceeding. How does it go? Where are you now in this process? Are they trying to get summary judgment? Are you trying to get summary judgment against them? Are they trying to dismiss the lawsuit? Where are we in the courts?
Sure. So we filed in the Circuit Court for Baltimore City, which is a state court, and the defendants, Westminster, tried to remove the case and have removed the case at the moment to the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, which is the federal court. So clearly they want to litigate in the federal court system. They still have to show that they qualify to litigate in the federal court system, and we're still waiting on them to provide sufficient documentation that they qualify. They've also filed a motion to dismiss the complaint. We've briefed the motion, and that motion is currently also pending before the U.S. District Court.
Okay, and then what's the timeline? What do you expect?
Well, we hope that the court will resolve both issues, whether or not it even has jurisdiction to decide the case, or whether or not it should be, you know, taken back to the state court, and then two, whether or not the court should dismiss the complaint. If the court does not dismiss the complaint, then the parties move toward what's called discovery, where we get to find out what information they have, and they get to find out what information we have. And then, as you said, the case could proceed to some sort of summary judgment or a jury trial.
Does it matter whether the case is heard in the federal court or the state court?
Well, we filed in the state court. We believe that there are sufficient ties between Westminster and Maryland that the case should be heard in the state court. Westminster's claiming that under some technical legal rules that they should be able to have it heard in the federal court. But we believe that the harm is in Maryland, and so Maryland state courts are competent to decide this matter, and if the burden's on Westminster to show that they qualify for the special federal jurisdiction.
Matt, we have about 90 seconds left. The issue of affordable housing is becoming a premier issue, certainly here in Washington, D.C. The demographic change in the city is so dynamic. I mean, Washington, D.C. was 75-80% African-American 25 years ago. Today, it's less than 50% African-American. As a consequence of these very aggressive practices by real estate companies in cahoots with the banks, in Baltimore, is there a housing movement that is paying attention to this case? In other words, not just people fighting in the courts, but maybe fighting in the streets or in our communities?
There certainly are a lot of folks working in sort of a fair development, affordable housing sort of framework, really trying to lift up in the individual struggles of different communities. And, you know, while Baltimore is kind of almost even more a tale of two completely different cities in some ways, where you have skyrocketing rents and ownership costs in certain predominantly white, usually, neighborhoods, and you just see incredible disinvestment, vacants, and all sorts of other social ills and crime in the majority of the city, which is predominantly African-American. And so there are a lot of groups. We're part of a group called the Baltimore Housing Roundtable that's working with community land trusts around the city to really talk about what are the grassroots, community-driven solutions to some of the fair development sort of crisis that we see, where we need new investment, where we need to see that we can do development without displacing current residents. And we're certainly hoping that we, instead of necessarily relying on large profit-driven landlords, we can put development back into the control of the communities and meet community needs without having to resort to less appealing options.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We wish you the very best of luck. Say one more time for those in the area who might be eligible to join the class. What's the number once again?
Sure, 877-625-9409.
Okay, that was Matt Hill. He's an attorney for the Public Justice Center representing aggrieved tenants in the class action lawsuit brought against Kushner and his companies. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're going to talk about the discussions going on between North Korea and South Korea. We're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Welcome back, Professor Chun.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. These are big announcements coming out of the inter-Korean talks between North and South. North Korea has said it will send a big delegation to the Olympics, and both sides have agreed to open up a military collaboration. Talk about what both of those planks mean.
Absolutely. This is truly amazing. And North Korea has agreed to send a delegation to next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. And most importantly, to hold talks with Korea to ease tensions, military tensions in the Korean Peninsula. In fact, the delegation, I think, is going to be the largest ever. And also the two Koreas obviously will continue talk. And the high-level delegation that will include athletes, North Korea's famous cheering squad, I remember, beautiful ladies, and an art troupe, a visitors group, and taekwondo demonstration team, and a full press corps. And also they say the another major important element is that both Korea's, although they didn't mention the June 15th North and South Korean Declaration in 2000, both Koreas really stressed the importance of Koreans themselves, inter-Korean collaboration to address the issues facing serious security faces in the Korean Peninsula. And another one that I wanted to also make clear is that both Korea also agrees that joint effort to the what they call the unity of the people and also reconciliation to create an environment for a peace process. And before this, before the yesterday's agreement, this has also been truly historic because the way it has been progressed, number one, it was just the speed of the inter-Korean talks this time has been truly unprecedented. Since literally every day since the New Year's, we had a major announcement and also agreement. And most And second thing is that, as you know, the talks yesterday was about, you know, more than 10 hours. And even from the very beginning, the two, the delegation, the team, the representative had a very cordial, friendly interaction, unlike the previous talks. And the one last thing that I want to also mention, how important and also the, which is, we should also feel good about, is that it just didn't end there. For South Korean side, it was very important for South Korea to leave the follow-up meetings and the hopes. So which is exactly what happened. There is a further promise for their talks and follow-ups. So in all things considered, I think this has been a very, very good day.
We're speaking from Seattle with Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You can hear this show loud and clear every day in the Washington, D.C. area between 4 and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. Professor Chun, I want to follow up on a point that you just mentioned, and that is the tempo of developments, the speed, the dynamism. I just have a theory about that, and I want to see if you agree with my theory. My theory is that Kim Jong-un made this speech, the New Year speech, where he offered to, have a real dialogue. He said very practical and specific things about how North-South relations could be improved. And as you mentioned, the South Koreans responded like within 24 hours and said yes. And then the North Koreans said yes back, and the South Koreans said yes and proposed talks, and the talks are happening within a week. It seems to me that both Koreas are aware that if the train leaves the station and leaves at a high enough speed, it may be harder for people in Washington to derail this train. In other words, it becomes a fait accompli, facts on the ground, so to speak. Is that a plausible theory?
I think that there is truth to that. And everyone was surprised at the speed of the two inter-Korean talks. And as you mentioned, this was truly very different from previous talks. As you also mentioned, that Kim Jong-un chose, if you look at the Kim Jong-un's New Year speech, there weren't a lot of rhetoric, which he used, which was like in the past. He chose a very concrete, actionable, also deliverable agenda. So, which showing that, he himself is ready to act. And the second is obviously the Olympic is, which I think not many people really point out, else even American media. The Olympics truce peace process was not Kim Jong-un's, obviously. He couldn't propose this, but it was President Moon Jae-in's agenda, right? So, in fact, President Moon Jae-in proposed this last year as soon as he was actually elected. And in a way, what we have is that Kim Jong-un, obviously, he has about several months to think about it. And it was just a response to President Moon's effort. It was not, a lot of people think, Trump is giving himself credit. All my bellicose hardline talk really made North Korea come to the table, which is not true. This is basically Kim Jong-un saying yes to the offer from President Moon Jae-in that had, made more than several months ago. But the point that you make is important, though. This has all the elements, even when you look at try to do some kind of closing sales or deal, sometimes it's very important to have that momentum, creating a sense of urgency. Of course, we have this most, in this case, we have most concrete deadline. We have Olympics coming up, and you better act quickly. And so in this case, it has all that elements of, speeding up the process and get some things done. And if you also look at the content of the agreement, I was very impressed by the unity, the coherent message. They didn't really seem to be sidetracked, although at the end of the meeting, there was some discord. South Korean delegates, I guess, probably wanted to include something about denuclearization of North Korea and for peace process. And the North Korean, head of North Korean delegate, Mr. Ri, strongly reacted to that. But nevertheless, it looks like the message was very clear, actionable, and consistent, and something that people can, understand.
Professor Chun, I'm looking at an article published yesterday at Foreign Policy magazine, and it's entitled, "It's Time to Bomb North Korea."
Yes, I read that.
It says in the opening paragraph that nothing can be known about this week's talks between the North and the South other than their likely outcome. And I'm quoting here, "As in every previous encounter, South Korea will almost certainly reward North Korea's outrageous misconduct by handing over substantial sums of money, thus negating long overdue sanctions recently imposed by the United Nations Security Council. Meanwhile, the North will continue to make progress toward its goal of deploying nuclear-armed missiles, mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles, having already tested nuclear explosive devices," and then it has a list of dates. I'm also looking at a Reuters piece that came out today saying that, really agreeing in substance with what you're saying, that these are the first direct talks in more than 2 years. This is very, very important. But that North Korea's nuclear program will not be discussed. So what does that do for Washington's perspective on these talks? And do you think Washington's perspective matters if the North and the South are speaking directly?
Washington's you know, the some within obviously the Hawks hardline analysts recommending the surgical strike against North Korea. And if you look at their argument, what they're saying is, oh, you know, it's not going to be full blown nuclear war. We just wanted to the surgical strike and then you know, let the North Korea learn the lesson. And but which is not realistically, that's not going to work out. All the analysts point out that any military tension in the Korean Peninsula will transform into a full-blown war. Second point is that yes, it is. It's just amazing how in this atmosphere, this is this very rare moment when North and South Korea meeting for the first time in 2 years after 1 year in year of an incredible, really unbelievable hardline bellicose talk coming from Trump administration, including President Trump himself. Now we have this rare, rare, truly precious moment, delicate moment, that there are so much of the American media, some of them are focusing on this, you know, the appeasement theory and also the how this is going to waste of time and this is going to, North Korea wanted to lay trap and North Korea is going to just, it can't be trusted, etc. So this is, I think it's really important for us to respond to every single point that these people are making. However, the second point that I think we do want to also point out is that there are others who are also coming up with a very concrete proposal, even from the former State Department officials, you know, who worked in the North Korean affairs. And for instance, they argue that, in this time, what the United States can do is to, first of all, for this specific Olympic period, they should let North Korea to work on it. And secondly, United States should send a strong, very consistent foreign policy message as well. It has going to, is very confusing. There's only one, there's, as you mentioned, there are Hawks. On the other hand, there is others who are also proposing diplomatic engagement. And President Trump should, as a president, he should send a strong signal about going with proactively diplomacy, which means that, as you know, some of those analysts point out, even after this Olympic truce, you can scaling down of the U.S.-South Korean joint military drills, the war game. Secondly, also, South Korea can probably act as a facilitator, mediator between North Korea and United States talk, which will include small steps such as, North Korea, United States allowing North Korean non-governmental, unofficial visits, and also ease some of the financial regulations. Of Americans who can Korean Americans who can travel North Korea, and also allow those limited commercial export of humanitarian goods to North Korea. As you know, more than 70% of people are affected by this U.S. led sanctions, and also some of those State Department officers who are holding talks. Who have been talking with North Korea, give them more, sort of freedom and the legitimacy. And so all these things, small steps, I think can be done by Trump administration without really going, to make a major a polished shift.
Brian, you've been to North Korea many times. I've never been to North Korea. And there's a travel ban for Americans now, so we couldn't go if we wanted to.
You're living in the free world, and in the free world, you must stay.
You must stay. You cannot travel freely in the free world. I'm wondering, it seems to me that logically, travel to North Korea is a good thing. Should be a good thing, right? International understanding, you get to know each other, cultural exchanges, that kind of thing. Am I missing something? Should Americans not be traveling to North Korea?
No, people should be traveling to North Korea. Matter of fact, I set up an organization a couple of years ago called Korea Peace Tours with the intention of bringing Americans to North Korea. And we worked it out with a travel agency. We got permission from the North Korean Travel Bureau, whatever it's called. And we sent a couple delegations. Matter of fact, the last one went right before the September 1st ban. And it was a group of educators who went to North Korea, and I was really encouraging them to go to meet with other people in their profession, also educators. And so they did go, and they got in just under the deadline. all of the people who I've talked to who have gone to North Korea, either with these tours or other people, they're always, to a person, astonished about the fact that North Korea and the image that they had of North Korea do not comport. In other words, when you go to North Korea, the North Koreans say, you should come here because seeing is believing, which of course it might be and it might not be, but nothing takes the place of people actually going someplace and looking at it and seeing the people and seeing how they act and seeing how they interact and seeing how they interact with you before you make a judgment. And really the missing link here is the profound ignorance about North Korea among Americans and also a profound ignorance about the Korean War. It's the forgotten war. Like we all know about Vietnam, but the Korean War was a forgotten war. And I want to actually talk, if we get a moment, to talk about why it became forgotten. But as a consequence of all of that, there's no real understanding from Americans about Koreans and specifically North Koreans. And I think if Americans could go to North Korea in large numbers, there would be such reciprocity from the part of the people of North Korea. And I think a lot of Americans who would become less ignorant would be less susceptible to having hate-filled images, which is always promoted in the U.S. media about North Korea.
And so if an American goes to North Korea, he's not going to see people eating grass or bark off of trees to survive or secret police surrounding him and following him everywhere he goes or...
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I went to North Korea in 1989. That was right before the Soviet Union collapsed. It was right after the Tiananmen Square incident. Matter of fact, I was in Beijing the week after Tiananmen Square, June 1989. When you went to North Korea at that time, you saw a thriving economy. The fields were blooming. The harvest was big. The people were obviously confident. They were well fed. There's a lot about North Korea that showed that they were an economic success, certainly by third world standards. I went again in 2000 and 2001. The situation in the late 90s and the mid 90s had deteriorated drastically for North Korea. There was a famine. The caloric intake of the people was not sustainable. The North Korean government was very open about this.
In fact, it sought international food aid.
They sought international food aid. And the same thing happened to Cuba. I mean, all the countries, the smaller socialist bloc countries that lost their trade partners, lost their energy, lost their spare parts, they were plunged into economic crisis. And at the same time, North Korea had successively, year after year, a terrible weather, tidal waves and
drought.
I mean, everything that could go wrong went wrong within that same few year period. But I have to tell you, the last time I went to North Korea, I wanted to go this year, but it hasn't worked out. And now there's the travel ban. The last time I went was 4 years ago, 2013. The country was back on its feet. It's maybe not where it was, but it's certainly not famine. People aren't eating bark. They're not eating grass. That's not what's happening right now in the DPRK. Anyway, again, this is why it's important for Americans and people from the West to go to North Korea and see for themselves what it's like.
So in light of these talks, I'm going to ask Professor Chun, do you think that there will be ease of travel for South Koreans now to go visit relatives, family members from whom they've been separated in North Korea? What do you see coming out of these talks in the short term?
I think they will coming up in the short term. And in fact, South Korea, during this the first talk yesterday, did go to the meeting with including that agenda of, resuming the reunion of separated families. There was hope, especially during the Lunar New Year's, which is a very big one of the two biggest holidays in Korea, which would have been, which would have been much appreciated. But I guess it was this time somehow that two Korea couldn't agree on that agenda. Maybe it was there too much demand agenda. It was, too short on notice because it requires an incredible amount of coordination. In fact, as once again, we are reminded that Kim Jong-un's New Year speech that he would like to see, the visit from South, the visit from both Koreas, between two Koreas from all walks of society, the party officials, leaders, politicians, civilians. So I think that that is going to be happening. But the one issue that is, I think, at the hurdle will be that, again, North Korea is still under the, obviously, UN sanctions, which also limit the what South Korea, even the citizens can, or a foreign government can, interact with North Korea. So that is something that I think we really have to address. And I think in that sense, probably this is, we are still asking what United States, how United States can help or even sort this very delicate process. This is where probably as those of us who are working activists and in United States should really make the issue. And we should really, really, really zero in and stress the importance of, it's not government level officials, but, civilians, citizens, interactions, cultural interactions, social, educational, and also specifically the one that, Brian was mentioning. I think this year, what my expectation is that if it's not for during the Winter Olympics, I think we will definitely see more interactions, exchanges between two Korea this year, independent of any, talks, the nuclear talks, or any even U.S. DPRK relationship.
Let's talk about what the sanctions on the DPRK do. I mean, personally, I think the sanctions are terrible. Sanctions punish people. They punish the civilian population. They deprive a population of food and medicine because powerful countries that control the world economy have decided they don't like the policies of their government, or they don't like that government. So they impose punishing economic sanctions. What's the point of economic sanctions? The very well-to-do and the very well-connected always get food. In fact, you can create a new sort of black market in a sanctions regime. That certainly happened in Iraq.
It actually strengthens regimes. That's what we saw in Iraq.
Yeah. So it's this kind of cruel, barbaric imposition of economic suffering on the people. And then maybe people who impose the sanctions can say, oh, we're doing something short of war. But on the other hand, what's the goal of the sanctions? Well, obviously, the goal is really to make the people suffer so much that maybe they'll rise up against their government. I mean, that was the plan with Iraq. Like, why impose all that suffering on the Iraqis? They thought, well, eventually the Iraqis will say, uncle, let's get rid of Saddam. By coup d'etat, by some measure, and then the sanctions can be lifted. It's a regime change strategy, but it doesn't work.
It always has been. You can ask the Castros about sanctions. They'll tell you everything you want to know. It doesn't have an impact except to harm innocent people.
Yeah, and now depriving a country like North Korea of oil, of coal. The U.S. wanted to have a complete oil embargo on North Korea. That would mean there would be mass starvation. I mean, that would be, here you have the U.S. government condemning the famine-ridden leader, the country that led by Kim Jong-un. But the goal of American policy is to do just that. It's to create famine. I mean, let's call it for what it is. Isn't that a crime against humanity?
I think that this is truly, the sanction is, as Professor John Delery and Yonsei University call, this is strategically and morally dead end. That's exactly what it is. It is inhumane. It's a crime. In fact, it really tried, it's purposefully targeting those, could argue that civilians. And something that I always look at, when I, although I'm Korean, I never had a chance to visit North Korea. Of course, I was forbidden. I'm still a Korean citizen. Sometimes when you look at the North Korean, there are people, obviously these sanctions do not affect the elite. And as you can see, the way, elite a little bit there, relatively well fed, whereas the rest of the population. But I think this time the sanction is that it is, it's really, I would say, U.S. induced famine. If there is going to famine, that's what it exactly is going to be. Or United Nations induced a famine. And so this is really, I think, with this small windows opportunity open, I think we should really stress that. And another thing, I think we, in the last the week when we talked about it, Hyun Lee pointed out, suppose what happened if 90% of oil is, cut? What happened? How would you feel in the United States? There will be massive a crisis. And the most importantly, for North Koreans who have, if you look at it, even, those people who have suffered in the previous famine, and this is really, this is not something, it's not trivial. This is life and death situation. It is literally trying to kill someone while they're trying to survive, right? We're talking about regime survival. We're talking people's survival, which needs to be talked about.
I want to jump in here because I want to tell a short story about how this happens. I was also involved in taking medicine to Iraq in violation of the sanctions regime imposed by the U.S. and the U.N. I took lots of medicine to Iraq in the late 1990s. When I was there in May 1998, I got a small cut on my ankle, and that turned into a staph infection, and it ran up my leg, and I couldn't put my shoe on, I couldn't put my pants on. And luckily, because we had brought antibiotics and we had doctors with us, I was treated. And that antibiotic treats the staph infection. Without the antibiotic, within a day or two, I would have died. That's what happens with those kind of infections. The Iraqis didn't have those antibiotics. The United Nations prevented Iraqis from getting antibiotics. Now, how can you describe that as anything other than a crime against humanity? Because the people who get staph infections because they have a small cut on their foot, and a lot of people were going barefoot at that point in Iraq, they had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. They had nothing to do with the invasion of Kuwait. It's really an anti-people policy. Anyway, it's sort of tangential, but I just want to bring it home to people that this is real, as Professor Chun is saying. This is real devastation directed against human beings who happen to be Koreans living in the northern part of the Korean Peninsula. We have 90 seconds left. Professor Chun, go ahead.
Yeah, this is, I think, the form of warfare. The sanction itself is a form of warfare, and which really increase the suffering of the people who have nothing to do with the regime. I think one argument you make is some people say, well, the sanction will work eventually because people are going to, tired of the dictator and they're going to overthrow. In my experience, all the cases that we looked at, really, really hungry, starving, desperate people, really, it's hard for them to rise up against anything. Actually, when you look at it, a lot of revolution took place actually in the country that has a small, incredible number of a middle class. So that is where actually, if those people want to really see kind of internal regime change, what they should do take is, consider Kim Jong-un as a developmental dictator, just like, let's say, in the case of many developmental dictators who, developed their economy and authoritarian politics. And then slowly they create middle class, and then, there will be some kind of democratic changes. So I think at this point, I think if we can wrap up, this has been truly, we had a good talk, good progress, good results yesterday. Even within 24 hours, we can see how amazing diplomacy can do within 24 hours. Something that we have spent so many, I remember, times to think about this, imagine this talk.
It's very promising. And I know within Korea, both the North and the South and among overseas Koreans, there will be a sense of optimism and hope right now. We're out of time. We've been joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.